On Sunday, July 8th at 11 p.m., Sugar My Bowl presents Milford Graves, Full Mantis, with director Jake McGinsky. We'll also revisit our interview with Milford Graves as we discuss his career, his association with the Black Arts Movement, and much more. That's Sunday, July 8th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar My Bowl's the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones, and I am joined by our associate producer, Hank Williams, this evening as we have a discussion with percussionist, drummer, acupuncturist, herbalist, gardener, builder, scientist, inventor, martial arts master, Milford Graves. We'll open this program with a conversation with director Jake McGinsky. Jake McGinsky is the director of Milford Graves Full Mantis, which will be screening at Metrograph at 7 Ludlow Street in downtown Manhattan starting July 13th. We have the link for the theater at our Sugar My Bowl website. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl starting now. My bowl. I want some sugar in my bowl.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones. I'm on the line with
Jake McGinsky.
Jake McGinsky, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl. And Jake McGinsky, for those who may not know, is the co-director of Full Mantis. This is a documentary that features percussionists, and that is just a minor introduction of who this person is, master percussionist Milford Graves.
Indeed.
Hi, Jake.
Joyce, how are you?
Okay. So you co-direct this film with Neil Young?
I directed the film, and Neil's the co-director. That's how it's credited.
And what is his participation as a co-director?
Well, I've been working on this project for about 15 years,
right,
and around the same amount of time I've been a student of Professor Graves, and was shooting the whole time. Neil got involved about 3 years ago. I invited him in to come down and shoot the show at Brandeis University, which is featured a couple times in the film, and really dug on the footage that I saw, so kind of invited Neil to shoot more, and from that point on, Neil was involved in the creative process, and then as we started editing, we were editing. Neil's a drummer, too. Came into the project in the later phases, but was a great collaborator.
Are you still a student of Professor Graves?
Indeed, yeah.
You had started 15 years ago. What was the inspiration? What made you want to do this? Because I understood you were also working to digitize a lot of his material.
Right. Well, my relationship with Professor Graves started when, you know, I'd been a fan. I'm a drummer. I've been drumming my whole life. And as you grow up drumming, you go through different great drummers. And my curiosity led me to people like Elvin Jones and Ed Blackwell and the great drummers of Ornette Coleman and John Coltrane. And little by little, the people at the record store in Springfield where I grew up would give me other records or other CDs to check out. And eventually you make your way to Milford Graves. Once I heard Percussion Ensemble, which was the first record I'd ever heard that just featured drums only, and became kind of obsessed with that record while I was still in high school. So I would practice to that record and I would listen, kind of devoured everything that I could find of Milford's music. And in 2002, he came to UMass to play a solo for the Magic Triangle Solos and Duos series. I went to that, was super blown away by both the energy of the music live and just the performance presence, and was kind of captivated by some of the things he was talking about in between playing. So I decided I would kind of change my life around and figure out a way to study with him. So I drove to his office and kind of waited for him to show up and asked him if he would take me on as a student. And he kind of looked me up and down and said, well, we'll see what the story is, and invited me in. Pretty soon after that, I was working as his assistant at Bennington College. He was really generous with me. I would do the intro percussion classes and the advanced percussion classes, and then we would have one-on-one lessons after that. So I started recording him initially kind of just for my own journey as a student to understand some of the things that he was talking about in a deeper way and to have the chance to reflect on them and take notes on some of the lessons and things like that. But pretty soon I had a hard drive going with a lot of material and started doing some video projects with him and for him for different reasons, you know, shooting in the garden for a lecture that he had, kind of amassing a lot of material with the idea of kind of one day contributing to the larger archive. And then probably around 6 or 7 years ago, he started sharing archival footage with me that no one had seen. And I started digitizing that and keeping that on a separate hard drive. And when I saw the footage of Milford Graves and Ben Tanaka performing at the School for Children with Autism in Japan, I kind of realized there was definitely a piece of cinema in here that could be developed into a feature film, and started kind of working on that. So it's been a long-term process. Really, it's been a labor of love that just gained momentum over time and has now come alive on the screen in this form. But it's part of an ongoing relationship and an ongoing process, really. I'm still recording with the professor and we're still involved in projects. I really see the film as just another lesson amongst many lessons that I've received and that I'm still receiving as a student.
Well, thank you so much for this contribution. You know, when I heard about this film, it was actually via Billy Martin, the percussionist with Medeski Martin and Wood, and also the president of the Creative Music Studio, Billy Martin. He had seen the film at Lincoln Center, Film Society at Lincoln Center. It was showing there, was part of a festival.
The festival is called Art of the Real.
Right. How did you wind up being screened as part of that festival?
Well, the film has been on the festival circuit since January when it had its world premiere at International Film Festival at Rotterdam. The way that works is sometimes the film is submitted for festivals and other times it's invited. So this was one of the instances where the film was invited by the curators. Art of the Real, I don't think there's films submitted. So there's a curatorial team and they're watching films that are currently in the festival circuit and inviting films that they want to show. So we were honored to receive an invitation to screen at Lincoln Center for the New York premiere. And then we had our first screening on the second night of the festival, but so many people came out for tickets that they sold that one out and scheduled the second screening, which was the only film of that festival that screened twice.
Wow.
But it was great to be there, and Milford and his family came to the opening night, including his granddaughter and all five of his children. So that was really special.
And now the film will be screening at Metrograph. Yay, for those like myself who hadn't had an opportunity to see it. But the screening at Metrograph on July 13th, it starts July 13th. The opening night at Metrograph is going to be a pretty special occasion as well, I understand. Milford Graves is going to visit?
Yeah, Milford's going to be there to do a Q&A. The Q&As have been really fantastic at many of the screenings. I'll be there to do the Q&A with Milford, and William Hooker is going to do a short introduction and present the film. So it's going to be a special night all around. And that'll be Friday night, the 7 o'clock round. The film will actually start that day with a matinee. It's going to play 3 times a day, starting on the 13th all the way through that week.
Wow.
And who knows, if enough people come out through the week, maybe it'll play 2 weeks. That'll be fantastic.
Starting Friday, July 13th, running through Thursday the 19th. And hopefully it will be extended.
Please come out if you've seen Milford perform or if you haven't. The film is constructed to kind of share in a really special musical philosophy and creative philosophy. It's, I think, something that people who care deeply about music, but also people who care deeply about experience, and it has a humanist vibe, just like Milford does. And I hope everyone can have a chance to see it on the big screen. That's really the way we put it together, was with the idea that people would be getting together to see this and sharing it as a community and collectively. While eventually it'll be available in other formats, I think the best way to see it is surrounded by other human beings in a movie theater. And the Metrograph is a really great theater for those of you who haven't been there yet. It's new on Ludlow Street downtown, and it's a beautiful theater. Comfortable. Hope to see you there.
7 Ludlow Street, Metrograph. And I have to tell you, with regard to this film, Full Mantis, I really appreciate the way you shot it. Since it is a labor of love, it is definitely, it focuses on Milford Graves. I got to say, I love this kind of filmmaking. It focuses on the subject as opposed to the filmmaker. You don't have yourself inserted in there at any point. Was that intentional?
I don't know if it was intentional, meaning I had to like think a lot about keeping myself out. I think you start putting images together and the film starts to have its own voice and it starts to ask to be what it wants to be. And it seemed like it wanted to be an experience for people that put people into the position of the learner. While my understanding of Milford's teachings and ideas is part of the content of the film, kind of the lessons that were most profound for me, that affected me most deeply, they're in there, but they're also parsed against the things that the professor seemed to want to share most with people. And I think the film's really constructed to have his energy transfer directly to the audience rather than be some sort of exploration of me or our relationship per se. Mm-hmm. But I'm there and I see it as almost out of a sense of duty to share in Milford's message, which I think is a really, really important one, and one that will likely be studied for hundreds and thousands of years if we can stay on the planet that long.
The film, in your telling of the story, it includes images of the garden in the backyard of Milford Graves' home and studio and workspace, a spaceship. Mm-hmm. And the film is narrated and the music is from Milford Graves. It is as much information that you have, I guess, to this point of Milford Graves is expressed through this movie. It is in the voice of Milford Graves, and that makes it worth seeing right there for me.
Yeah, the only voice in the film is the voice of Milford. I think there's something about watching films about creative process and about artists. You know, you only have an hour and a half, and sometimes it can take that long to be able to learn, kind of acclimate towards the way someone talks about things. And I always appreciate getting, as an audience member, time to spend with an artist and with the creative philosophy. So it's not a film that has talking heads or people coming in and telling the audience what they're supposed to think in terms of value about different parts of history or different parts of the discography or performance history. It's really focused on Milford's creative philosophy, and the garden is part of that. The garden, I think, was a great kind of bed for cinema, because I think in Milford's world, the garden is many things, just like all the elements of his life. It's a place for creativity, a place to draw inspiration from. It's also providing nourishment for him and his family and food. It's an ecosystem for insects and animals. I think you can look at any element of his environment and you can see the way he's able to use the different aspects of his sensorial experience there to create. So the garden is a source, the martial arts are a source, the drum kit is a source. And that's the whole concept of the film, the Full Mantis. It's going straight to the source, cutting out any middle person. I guess that in any way that, as you mentioned before, kind of taking myself out, and that's part of that, is just trying to provide as much direct access to the source of the creative inspiration that makes the foundation for the film.
By the way, is this the introduction to your further expression as a filmmaker, or this is a one-shot deal?
I think for better or for worse, yeah, I plan on making more films. I had been really just excited by showing this all around the world and watching people come to Milford's creative philosophy from all different walks of life. I can't tell you how many times I've met someone after a screening who had never heard music like that, had never heard of Milford, who was now going to look him up online and buy all his music. To see the power of cinema and the power of that institution, everyone watches movies everywhere. And I think it's a really powerful form of expression and a great way to tell stories and to share experiences.
Well, Jake Maginski, I love the way you tell a story. And people, check out Full Mantis at Metrograph. Now, I understand also you shared that the opening night is selling out quickly. So people need to check out. We'll make the link available on our website to get tickets for...
The full title is Milford Graves, Full Mantis.
Okay.
The title, of course, references Milford's martial art that he invented, Tiara. And the Full Mantis is a quote from the film, actually, as Milford's describing the way the martial art came to be, the relationship to directly observing insects in his yard. And yes, Metrograph on Friday, July 13th is the opening. The 7 p.m. round of that day will be the screening that Milford will be at, and that's the currently on sale at the Metrograph website, and it is selling out pretty fast. I think there's a couple dozen seats left now, but I hope you can be there. There'll be other introducers throughout the week. Susie Ibarra, a great drummer, will be introducing one night, and also I believe William Horberg, who's also part of the Creative Music Institute with Billy Martin, will be doing an introduction, and then some other big surprises along the week.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Jake Maginski, and we'll see you on July 13th.
Sounds good, Joyce. Thanks for having me.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm here with Hank Williams, associate producer of Sugar in My Bowl, and we're talking to
Milford Graves.
Milford Graves, thank you for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
Okay.
We appreciate the time you're going to spend with us. If I understand it correctly, you were born in Jamaica, Queens?
Yes, I was born here in Jamaica, Queens.
What was the music like around there growing up?
Church music. A lot of church music. Actually, in this area that I was raised in, I was told that there were a lot of people from South Carolina that migrated into this area up here. So they did have a lot of blues around here.
Oh.
They did have a Latin band. I listened to a lot of Latin, but they did have a band around here that was African Americans that played Latin. Not too far away from here, maybe 10 blocks over, Ella Fitzgerald was living here.
Oh, wow.
They had a place called Hank's Bar that I never verified this, but they told me that, which was actually about 5 blocks from me. So on this corner called Guy Brewer Boulevard now, but it used to be New York Boulevard and 108th Avenue, and they told me that Miles Davis lived in a house right across the street from Hank's Bar.
Oh.
I don't know how true this story is, but right. Guy was telling me that there were so many trumpet players so good that Miles couldn't even function in the session. I don't know if that's true. That could have been somebody just talking just a lot of nothing, you know, but I'm just mentioning that used to be a club there that I don't know too much about, but evidently they had jam sessions there. But as a teenager, you know, a lot of people lived out this area, from Count Basie to Milt Jackson. Charles McPherson actually used to live down the block from me. And so we had a whole bunch of people in McCoy Tyne. Of course, Coltrane was living on Mexico Street. So somehow everybody had to come out here to Queens, Jamaica, St. Albans. Plus, a lot of sports people were out here, you know, Roy Campbell, Jackie Robinson. This was the area. It was functional in that sense, you know, that people just wanted to buy some homes or get out the city.
What brought you to the drum kit from playing Latin jazz percussion?
Well, primarily it was getting some gigs. There was no gigs playing Latin or Afro-Cuban.
Wow.
You would get gigs playing in jam sessions and basements and so on and so on, but it just wasn't no gigs. But that's only part of the story, to tell you the truth. Actually, I think a person named Dick Mesa, I have to give him a lot of credit, but he's no longer with us. He was a Mexican alto player. I met Don Elias, it must have been around 1962, I think. I was with this Latin jazz band, we was playing up Mount Vernon, and so this conga player named Bill Fitchell, who's no longer with us, told us about his friend Don Elias that was coming down from Rhode Island to hang out. So he came and he sat in with us. And then about a few months later, Don said they had a gig up in Boston, up in this place, Revere Beach. And he wanted me to come and play timbales. I said, fine. So I went up to Boston. Sometimes they would have these, you know, Latin nights, they call them. So one night, there was not too many people in there. So Dick said, let's play some jazz. And I said, jazz? I said, I don't want to play no jazz, man. You know, conga timbales, man. You know, I want some drums. You know what I mean? And so he said, man, come on, man. You know, play your timbales like you're playing jazz drums. I had my cymbals, my one cymbal. And so I was playing the ride, you know, and my left hand was flying, you know. So Dick said, wow, man, your hair's left hand, man. He said, you should play some trap drums. I said, man, I ain't playing no trap drums, man. I want to play timbales. So he started making me think. And then I met Hal Galper, the piano player. And I had met John Nebs when John Nebs was with Cal Jada, because Bill Fitch had joined Cal Jada's band and they came to New York City to do some performances.
Now, Bill Fitch was African-American as well, right?
Right, from New Haven, New Haven Projects, up from New Haven, Connecticut. And so Bill said to me, he says, I can't get you a gig, Cal Jada, man, because you've got John Ray. Because John Ray, you know, we play jazz, he plays traps and vibes. And Bill, no, I didn't want to play nothing but conga, you know, bongos, timbales.
Right.
He said, but, man, I can get you, you know, like be like the band boy, man. And I said, I'll be the band boy, I can hang out with Cal Jada. He said, yeah. I said, I got the gig, man. Because we knew what we was up to, you know. Bill said, you know, man, you know, then you can slip in. We can do some gigs. I can ask Cal, ask you to sit in.
Now, what's a band boy?
You know, we just take care of all the instruments, make sure they brought in. And, you know, you pack them up, and, you know, and so on and so on. But I didn't even do that. They gave me that title. I didn't, you know, I wanted any title. I said, man, if I can hang out with Cal, man, and you guys, man, I said, I'm in, Bill. And so we did a gig, man. We had Cal Jada jumping almost in the air. I remember Tommy Lopez was playing. I think he's that night with Eddie Palmieri. Not Eddie, his brother, Charlie Palmieri. And we did this gig. He was in Brooklyn, man. We played. And Tommy looked over at us, man. And I guess maybe he was surprised to see two African Americans playing where we played. Mm. And Bill, we were both playing conga, you know. So I held the bottom and Bill was keytoing. And okay. We tore that place up. You know, we taught it up. Cal Jada looked over us and said, wow, you know. So he went back to California, and I stayed in Queens. But let me get back to what happened with Hal Galpo. John Neves was playing bass. So while I was up in Boston playing a gig with Elias, I said, let me check out John Neves. So I went over to John Neves' house, and I met Hal Galpo. And they had a loft, and Hal Galpo was living downstairs. So I went to see John Neves one day, and he wasn't there. So I went down and hung out with Hal. And so Hal had these drums there. And he said, you want to buy these drums for $100? I said, $100, man, I'll buy them. But I was thinking what Dick Mason said. I should be playing traps, man. He said, because you can really play traps, man. Your concept. And I brought these drums, took them back to my loft. And at that time, I had met Giuseppe Logan. So Giuseppe came over to the house, and we started jamming. And I said, that's it. I'm going to hang out on these drums. Because there were some gigs, you know what I mean? People calling you for gigs, okay. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the one thing I will say, Joyce, I tell my Hispanic brothers, I say, man, y'all got to start opening them doors, man, to non-Hispanics who knows how to play congas, man.
I was going to ask you about that because I had read somewhere that was also a roadblock, the fact that you and Bill Fitch being African-American, the Latin artists were not as welcoming.
It was a major problem, you know, and I don't see too many people on the bandstand today. And I know they told me Gene Golden broken at one time, but
right.
I don't know. I know my guy Vincent George, who was playing with Conjunto Libre. He's Caribbean. I know he played a little bongo and whatever else, but at that time, it was ridiculous. With me, I was going to another thing, being in the fact that with the light skin, and I used to have my mustache all pencil sharped up, you know what I mean? Them guys come over and start speaking Spanish.
Oh, they thought you were Latino.
Yeah, I said, no Espanol. And they look at me, man, you know. But I said, this is crazy, man.
Yeah.
And I knew some people who changed their names. I said, I'm not changing my name.
They changed their name to sound more like they were Latin?
Yeah.
Oh,
I knew guys was doing that. Some people was doing it. I knew a guy that did that, and then it was horrible. Then they found out later, and all they said, he was biracial. It was crazy.
Oh, wow.
I said, what was that about? But you know what happened with Bill Fitch is that I worked the band that I had on a concert at Town Hall. And the reason I got the gig at Town Hall, because the guy who was the booking agent, he flipped out when I told him Chick Corea was my piano player.
Oh.
He was like 18, 19 years old. And so we did the gig at Town Hall, and on that concert was Cal Jada, Herbie Mann, and the Cuban Jam Session group. But Cal hadn't showed yet, but Willie Bobo was there. Because we opened up, and Willie Bobo heard us and came over to us, and Willie was very cool. Because at this time, Bill knew everything Mongo did, and I had all Willie Bobo down. So we took their stuff as young guys, you know, and we made it real slick.
Sure.
So that was something for me to see Willie come over. I'm listening to him on records, you know, and everything, follow him. And he comes over, like, with a smile and open arms, and I felt real good. But then Bill called me about a month or two later and said, man, Cal Jada called me. I said, Cal Jada called you? He said, yeah, they want to fly me out to California, man. They want me to play in the band. So Bill said, should I go? I said, Bill, you go out to California. You increase your name and reputation. You come back to New York and we got the band again. But he took a beating out there.
What happened?
Well, because he was in Spanish. Only person who he said that really was kind to him and he'd go to his house and they play a little bit was Armando Peraza.
Oh.
And what happened was that Bill got the gig because Cal Jada was looking all over the people. Because he had this guy, Monguito, who was playing, and he got arrested, something to that nature.
Okay.
And he needed a conga player, so he was trying to get Mongo back. And I mean, he was calling everybody. And Willie Bobo said, there's a young kid in New York, man, that should have the job. And it was through Willie that Bill got that gig. And then I saw Willie months after that. I was downtown in this restaurant on 52nd Street. And I went in and I started talking to Willie, man. He said, all the Spanish guys, man, they're getting on me, man. And I said, well, what they getting on you for, man? He said, because I recommended, man, a non-Spanish guy for the gig with Cal. And so Willie said, you know what I told them? They said, why'd you do that? He said, I told him he played better than all the Spanish guys. And after this day, I said, I take my hat off to Willie.
Wow.
Willie being Puerto Rican broke the rule.
Mm-hmm.
you know? And so then after that, that was really doing. Bill was writing me these letters back, disheartening letters about that. He would come off the stage, all the guys would turn their backs on him, you know? That flipped Bill out. It flipped him out. Bill never recovered from that. He came back to New York. He wasn't right. He always liked the culture, and he thought it was cool. He just played. And they just beat him. They beat him. They beat him psychologically and spiritually. They beat him down. I remember when Bill came back to New York, he said, man, if you got to play this tumbao. I said, what do you mean playing tumbao, man? I said, all that stuff you was doing on there, I said, you was breaking stuff off from something different, man. He said, man, no, you got to be typical, man. You got to be very straight and simple. I said, Bill.
Wow.
And he never recovered. They put him into that Hall of Fame. What is it, the Latin Hall of Fame or something?
Oh,
like
really?
That. Yeah, and they talk about he's one of the greatest kunga players ever. I said, yeah, I should have told him that when he was alive.
Wow.
Never told him, you should have told him that, you know. So I said, I'm getting out. That was it for me.
Yeah.
I said, I'm going to play traps. Mm-hmm. That's it.
So how did wind up bringing your way of playing? How did it formulate?
Well, it formulated because, you know, after you're playing with all them drum groups all the time, even though you're playing, you know, you got your little basic parts you play. At the same time, you know, you're playing your basic part, you're hearing all the other parts, and you get a chance to play all these parts. And then when you don't hear those parts as a whole, it's something empty, you know. You want to hear everything in there. So you know where I'm going. When I got to the trap set, I said, wow, I don't hear all them other parts. And I said, well, if I got all these drums, I'm going to play the parts. I'm going to hear all those parts, you know. And then knowing about the talking drum, I said, these drums got to talk. The skins got to talk a little bit, you know.
Right.
So, you know, I played my snare for a little bit, you know. And I was, you know, you're breaking in. You're a new kid on the block, so you hang out, you know. But then I said, it's time to get rid of that snare drum. And so I said, I got to go back and play some traditional stuff, but not as locked in as the traditional people do. I said, I just got to open it up and be a part of the new creative aspect with what we do here in the USA, taking everything from, you know, as Africans was brought here, we develop what we do and make that tie, you know, tie all the way from the motherland all the way to the Caribbean and put it all together. But you know something? I never try to be avant-garde or way out of nothing. I just say, I'm going to play. People may be avant-garde. You know, when somebody wrote about me saying that he's avant-garde, the first thing I did was got to the dictionary. I said, what is avant-garde? And I said, oh, that's what I'm supposed to be doing? I said, well, I don't know. That's news to me. You know, way out, free jazz and all that. I said, I always thought I was free.
Yeah.
You know, I said, so I looked at all that terminology. I said, nah, this has nothing to do with nothing.
Well, I noticed that you played with, and actually I'm wondering how that was for you. You played with Hugh Masekela and Miriam Makeba at one point?
Oh, yeah. I did that recording. And that was Makeba Sings. Yeah, that was at RCA. And I could have became her drummer.
What got in the way?
I think I was going to run into too many restrictions.
Oh, musical restrictions.
Right, oh. Right. Let's put it this way. I don't think it was a problem with Miriam because I was doing some stuff on there that seemed like it inspired her. But it seemed like the people that was in the forefront there that was going to be the music director said I was doing too much.
Oh.
But I said it didn't bother Miriam, so, you know, what are you talking about? I didn't say that to the person. I just
right.
Shut my mouth. And I remember Delorda, he was a bass player. He had a partnership with Ralph McDonald. They actually were doing some producing together.
The percussionist,
Salter,
Ralph McDonald.
Not Slaughter, Salter.
Okay.
He was on a date. And I remember after we did the track, he came on and said, man, you made that track happen. I said, well, the person who's in the forefront, I don't have to drop names and all that, you know. But I said, you know what? I'm out of here. I said, I'm not going to be in a situation where I'm going to be told you're doing too much and blah, 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 blah. And I said, too much.
Shove it, shove it, shove it, same for us. Adieu, nosso Senhor. Pra chuva parar, de molhar o meu vivo no amor. Que é meu tão lindo, é maquio e finir. É puro e belo, e inocente como a flor. Por favor, chuva no rio. E amor demais, e meu amor. Por favor, chuva no rio. Bye.
I guess you played with Bill Dixon before you met Albert Eiler?
No, I didn't play with Bill Dixon.
Oh, you didn't? Bill
and myself never played together.
You know, the thing that I was thinking about, the October Revolution, apparently you played during that concert series, is that
right? I played during that series, yeah.
Okay. What was that like, being involved in that? Were you aware of why it was happening?
No.
Oh.
That was 1964, and I'm coming on the scene.
Okay.
You know? So I'm coming right out of here from South Jamaica. Bedford Stuyvesant. I say Bedford Stuyvesant because Brooklyn was always like a second like home to me because
right.
Brooklyn was kind of always hip to me, you know.
But you went to high school there, right? You went to Boys High?
I went
high?
To Boys High
yeah.
before it became Boys and Girls High
right.
School. Right. You know, I'm just a good guy from the neighborhood kind of guy, you know, doing mm-hmm. athletics, a little basketball and running track. I didn't know nothing about no politics and or nothing of that stuff, you know. And then when 64 came along, and that was probably not directly through me, it was basically through Giuseppe.
Okay.
Because I convinced Giuseppe to come to New York from Boston. And then when he came here, he met Roswell and John. It was either one of them. He met them together or separately.
Roswell Ward and John Chikai?
Right.
Okay.
And he said, you want to go to this rehearsal, man? I'm going to this rehearsal. I don't even think he mentioned his names, and it happened to be the New York Quartet.
Ah.
And I'm going to this rehearsal down at Mike Snow's loft. So we was listening, and then they asked Giuseppe, you want to sit in? So Giuseppe sat in. Then Giuseppe said, well, could my friend sit in? So I went on sit on the drums. And after that, J.C. Moses didn't even want to speak to me no more because he lost his job. I took his job.
Oh, no.
You know, after they left, I stayed around and listened to the tape.
Uh-huh.
And they taped it. And I said, I play like that? You know? Joyce, I was amazed at myself. I said, wow, I'm playing like that. And John and Roswell looked at me and said, you're just the kind of drummer we was looking for. And I got that job. And then my name starts spreading like wildfire, man. This is new young drummer on the scene, man. I guess everybody said, this guy sounded like he'd be soloing throughout the whole tune. And people were coming out, man. All the drummers was coming out, and I'm just in amazement, you know? Because, you know, I just want to play. So when October Revolution came, I think that's when all of the kind of politics came in.
Now, if I understand that correctly, the October Revolution happened because of these festivals that were excluding artists of color. It was sort
because,
of elitist, because, too. They had, like, certain artists they wouldn't showcase during those festivals.
Yeah, because it was a kind of interracial type of thing, you know. I think with Burt Green and Roswell and Carla Bley, Paul Bley, and that was a little click thing, but... So I just enjoyed myself playing and different people coming out. But I didn't just know but so much because I had just come out in the scene. I was just stepping out.
Okay.
You know, so this was kind of a new ball game to me to be getting all this publicity, you know, and attention.
Well, I'm going to bring in my partner Hank right now so
right.
he can ask you a couple of questions.
Greetings, Mr. Graves.
Same to you.
Thank you, brother. We appreciate the time with you.
Okay.
I'd like to go back with you to the 1960s, if you don't mind. And
right, no problem.
And ask you some questions about that. One of the things you're known for is your collaborations with artists like Pharoah Sanders, Albert Eiler, Don Pullman,
right.
and the Black Arts Movement in general.
Right.
What brought you to that?
What brought me to that was the Mary Baraka.
Mm.
Black Dada Nihilismus. Against what light? Is false what breath sucked for deadness, murder, the cleansed purpose, frail against God. If they bring him bleeding, I would not forgive or even call him Black Dada Nihilismus. The Protestant love wide windows, color blocked to Mondrian, and the ugly silent deaths of Jews under the surgeon's knife. to awake on 69th Street with money and a hip nose. Black Dada Nihilismus, for the umbrella Jesus, Trilby intrigue, movie house presidents sticky the floor, BDN, for the secret men, Hermes, the blacker art, thievery, ah, they return, those secret gold killers, inquisitors of the cocktail hour, Trismegistus, have them in their transmutation, from stone to bleeding pearl, from lead to burning, looting. Did Montezuma find the West a gray, hideous space? From Sartre, a white man, it gave the last breath, and we beg him die before he is killed. Plastique, we do not have, only thin, heroic blades, the razor, or flail against them. Why you carry knives or brutal lumps of heart? Why you stay where they can reach? Why you sit or stand or walk in this place, a window on a dark warehouse where the mind's packed in straw? New homes, these towers for those lacking money or art, a cult of death, need of the simple striking arm under the street lamp, the cutters from under their rented earth. Come up, Black Dada Nihilismus, rape the white girls, rape their fathers, cut the mothers' throats. Black Dada Nihilismus, choke my friends in their bedrooms with their drinks spilling and restless for tilting hips or dark liver lips sucking splinters from the master's thigh. Black scream and chant, scream and dull, unearthly hollering. Dada, bilious, what ugliness learned in the dome, colored holy. I call them sin or lost, burned masters of the lost, Nihil German killers, all our learned art. Remember what you said, money, God, power, a moral code so cruel it destroyed Byzantium, Tenochtitlan, Comanche. Got it, baby? For Tambo, Willie Best, Dubois, Patrice, Mantan, the bronze buckaroos. For Jack Johnson, Asbestos, Tonto, Buckwheat, Billie Holiday. For Tom Russ, Louverture, Vesey, Bojack. May a lost god, Damballa, rest or save us against the murders we intend, against his lost white children. Black Dada Nihilismus.
And Mary Baraka was the one who did that.
Do you remember what the initial connection was, or right, where initial, you first encountered him?
That was with the New York Quartet when we did that recording together with Baraka. I liked his style because, primarily being brought up in South Jamaica houses, you know, I was one of the dudes on the corner, you know what I mean?
Right.
With Applejack and suspenders on, the suspenders almost up to my neck with big suspenders. I was jitterbugging. I was hanging out with all the dudes, you know what I mean? Mm. I was with the rough guys, you know what I mean? And we talking all this kind of talk and that talk. And then when we went to do the recording with the New York Art Quartet with Baraka, mm-hmm. I see this guy come in. He was all Ivy League, you know? And the way he was talking, I said, this dude's pretty cool, man. I'm used to all these dudes from the street corner. And I said, who's this brother? You know, the way he was dressed, man, I said, man, that's pretty different, man. You know, I liked his whole character, his mannerisms and everything, and he was just very polite. So I said, I want to hang out with this guy, man. So I used to go down to his house all the time on Cooper Square, man, when he was down there. And I'd be hanging out with him all the time, man. And he was always cool with me. And he was one of the guys who was really talking about me on the instrument. You know, he was really publicizing me.
Right, in his AppleCore's columns and elsewhere, I'm assuming.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And he was telling people about me. He was just the right person. But then when I would go up to his house, he would talk to me in a way that was never down. Like, we had an association, and I appreciated that because he was at the New School and he was at Columbia. And, you know, for me, man, to meet a guy, like I said, it's not from, like, the street corners, man. The guy who's a collegiate guy teaching college level and all that. That was a whole new thing, man. I wasn't used to seeing my brothers like that. So I was paying attention to him, man. You know, and I said, this guy's got something else going on, because I always wanted to delve into a different kind of thought process. But I couldn't do it, man, you know, back in the neighborhood. But I was able to do it with Baraka, to see a guy, man, and see the people that was paying attention to him at that particular time, from Leonard Bernstein, you name it, man. I mean, everybody was responding to this guy, but a lot of people don't talk about. I mean, I witnessed that in person. Letters he would show me, man, people would be sending books to him. They wanted Baraka's opinion on it, man. And I said, all these guys are sending you this stuff? So he was a guy, man. And then when he made that show, I was just saying, whatever he's going to do, I said, it's probably pretty cool, man. And then when he moved uptown, they said he wanted to do this Black Arts Theater up in Harlem.
Right.
I followed him. And by following him, and just previous before that time, I said, man, I got to get more politically correct to see what's going on other than just being some musician out here. And so that was basically my start. And then going up in Harlem, of course, I was meeting a whole lot of other people. And then what was happening was when people were hearing me playing, and it was probably because the way I played and the bands I had such a kind of improvisational free nature about it. They say, man, that's falling in with the movement, man. Y'all talking about liberation. And then that led me into Monsieur's bookshop, man, the Liberation Store bookshop, man. And I started educating myself. And that was really it.
So can you talk a little bit more about your activity with the Black Arts Repertory Theater and School? Were you actually involved in the opening parade down 125th Street?
I was in that parade.
What was that like? What was the reception of the community?
Oh, that was something else, man. We met in front of the Black Arts. Of course, we had the police car in front of us. And they said, well, you guys, man, you got to have the American flag up. Because all they have is the Black Arts flag.
Right.
But they had it on hand just in case. So they threw up the American flag and the Black Arts flag. And then Maraca and a few other people maybe in front. And then Albert, Dawn, and myself was right behind them. And then Sun Ra was right behind us.
Did he have the entire orchestra with him, or was it just Sun
Yes. He had a large orchestra.
Okay.
Because we had no wagon or nothing for me to be on the drums. I just took one drum and tied it around my waist like I was a marching drummer.
Wow.
But we just did what we did, and people, man, was on the sidewalks. They was out their windows. They was on the roofs because they didn't know what this was coming down the street. That should have been recorded. Never, I don't think. I don't know anybody recorded that. Police department may have it. Maybe the police department has it.
That's a possibility.
They may have it in their files, man.
So can you talk a little bit more about the connection between politics and art? Because I was looking at your essay, Black Music, New Black Revolutionary Art, and in that you write that the unity of black musicians and poets will clearly motivate and direct black people towards total liberation. How did you try to manage that that connection between politics and art?
Again, I guess I was getting my education in the fact of, man, a little history of what was happening with this music and how it was being controlled by people, man, you know, on all ends, you know, and that the artists, you know, we create this music. We had nothing, no say-so in here. And that's not only from just from the point of producing your music, but how we play this music. And I think it started for me when I was in the housing projects and we had some great doo-wop groups in there. And I remember the doo-wop groups would go downtown, do some auditions, try to get some recording date, and they would come back and say, well, you know, we were told that we were singing out of tune and we need some keyboard training and stuff. And we sort of say, y'all sound pretty good to us. And I never had an understanding what they were talking about. You know, you were singing out of tune, man. And then you see people do that and they go and they try to go to the conservatory or get some singing lessons and they don't sound right again. You can see something's missing. See, that feeling and that soul was missing. And that stuck into my head about what was right or what was wrong. And then as I started getting more into the so-called jazz area and listening to all these stories, man, and then seeing about the kind of situations in the clubs and listening to all older musicians talk, I said, you know, I said, something's wrong here, man. We have to be more than an artist. Then when I started getting a little better understanding of the politics and what economics is about, I said, I think we have to start to taking control of our own self, man. And then again, at that particular time, coming around 65, 66, I was making myself more aware of the history in this country. Everything from people being transported on them boats over here to the Americas and everything that took place. I was getting angry, man. I was getting very angry. And I said, it shouldn't be like this, man. People shouldn't have to be treated like this. And I said, I'm going to do everything in my power, man, to make sure that I'm not going to go out and contest people. And I don't have to live in your neighborhood. I said, but, you know, like, why don't we build up our own neighborhood? Why don't we start to put our own schools together? Why do we have to keep running to Manhattan or Juilliard? Mm-hmm. I said, we have none of this, man. I said, if we create this music and we know how it's supposed to be done, and why should we be processed in a way to accommodate someone else's understanding, man? But from the creative and innovative process, we're being reduced. So I said, and to this day, I said, you know, my thing is I'm not worrying about this political system, my political system, as much as I'm worrying about the fact is that no matter what people of African ancestry do, we're still being knocked around, tossed around, still being challenged. And I said, you know what? I'm not going to try to go and prove that I am an equal with no one else, man. I got to prove I'm equal with myself. I don't have to prove that with nobody else. But I got to make sure I'm equal with myself so I can function, man. So I have no more questions about my capabilities or how things work. So those were some of the major factors, man, that was involved. Gotcha. And that really understanding that, you know, we got to form our own recording companies. If you don't like what Downbeat's doing, man, if you don't like what Modern Drummer, because I hear to this day, people were talking about the racial aspect of this and racial aspect of this. I said, well, stop complaining, man. What you going to do for yourself, man?
What were some of the other activities that you did at the Black Arts Repertory Theater in school? Who were some of the people you played with, and were you involved in any of the classes that they had there?
Well, I'll tell you, I was teaching the class.
Can I ask you what it was about?
The Black Arts Repertory Theater, right, was the name. Now, we got to talk about the function of the Black Arts Theater. That's another thing we're talking
about. Okay, well, go ahead.
Because there wasn't no people really in the community in there. People were scared of the Black Arts Theater. Oh, yeah. You know, the Black Arts Theater lasted about a year.
Right.
There was so much internal stuff going on. But I'll tell you one thing. It was definitely a meeting point for a lot of the artists through there. Mm-hmm. Dancers, poets, activists, you name it. They was coming to the Black Arts. You know, and you'll see gatherings around there. We would have some different performances at time, but after they had a problem up there when Larry Neal got shot.
Right.
And when that hit the 6 o'clock news here and it hit the newspapers, didn't forget about it. The last thing I did at the Black Arts Theater was with, no, two things. I did something with Sun Ra, we played up there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I played with Albert Isla, and it was probably less than, it could have been two or three people in there from the community. And that's when Baraka left, you know, and there was so much going on, you know. So he had to go off to Newark. So it really never, even when we had classes up there, you had two people and you were lucky, or three people.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's why I said it was a name. Everything sounded good, but internally it was just artists hanging around inside. That's what it was about.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for July 8th. This segment features aerial listings of Sugar and My Bowl guests so you can see them live. And this week's guest is Jake Majinski. He's director of the documentary film Milford Graves, Full Mantis. And the film's got a run at Metrograph Theater in Manhattan from July 13th through 19th. Both Majinski and Graves will be at question and answer sessions on selected screenings during the first 2 days of the run. And we've got more listings for you this week, and we're also highlighting several performances that are free outdoor shows as part of the Jazzmobile and Newark Museum Jazz in the Garden series, so there's no excuse not to get out and see some fantastic music. We start with pianist Harold Mayburn, who leads a trio at Smoke in a continuing Monday night series on July 9th and 16th. He also leads a trio at Smalls on the 18th. And there's a free screening of the Lee Morgan documentary film, I Called Him Morgan, at the Newark Museum on July 11th. And you can see our review of it up on the blog. Hammond B3 organ master Dr. Lonnie Smith leads a trio at the Jazz Standard from the 11th through the 15th. Drummer Terry Lynn Carrington is at the Metrotech Commons in downtown Brooklyn for a free lunchtime show on the 12th, and that's part of their R&B festival series. Pianist Mark Carey's Harlem Sessions continues as a Saturday night series with late sets at Smoke on the 14th and 21st. Looking a little further ahead, guitarist Mary Halverson is at the Village Vanguard with Thumbscrew from the 17th through the 22nd. Percussionist Ray Mantia is at Grant's Tomb for a free outdoor concert on the 18th, and that's part of the Jazzmobile series. pianist Mark Carey is at the Newark Museum for a free lunchtime show on the 19th, and that's part of their Jazz in the Garden series. Drummer Bobby Sanabria is at Co-op City in the Bronx on the 24th for a free outdoor show, and that's part of Jazzmobile. You can also catch him at the Newark Museum for a free lunchtime show on the 26th, and that's part of their Jazz in the Garden series. Pianist Barry Harris will be at Harlem's Marcus Garvey Park for a free outdoor show on the 20th, and that's also part of Jazzmobile. Master drummer Michael Carvin leads a trio at Zinc Bar on the 21st. Vocalist Diane Reeves and saxophonist Jane Bennett and McKay are both at the Carramore Jazz Festival on the 21st. Finally, bassist Reggie Workman will be at Grant's Tomb for a free outdoor show on the 25th, and that's also part of the Jazzmobile series. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news, and sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website. If you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too, where we'd appreciate likes, tweets, and shares with your friends. And if you really like what we do, please help the station stay on the air by pledging whatever you can and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. The support WBAI link on the Sugar and My Bowl website has details, and we're grateful for any help you can give the station. This is Hank Williams signing off. With our bi-weekly schedule, we're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on air on Sunday, July 22nd. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
By the way, that's Jake McGinsky, whom we'd like to thank for sharing information about his film, Milford Graves, Full Mantis. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl continues.
Hi, this is Christian McBride, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
To WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl's the name of this program of which you've been listening. Our guest for this evening is Milford Graves, drummer, percussionist, scientist, and that's the abbreviated description. What you're hearing right now is First Meeting, Anthony Braxton, William Parker, and Milford Graves from Beyond Quantum. That's a 2008 Zedek Records release. I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, because there are several releases this evening on this label, and that's John Zorn's label, T-Z-A-D-K, Zedek. I'm guessing Anthony Braxton on alto saxophone, William Parker on bass, and Sopranino on others, and Milford Graves on drums. Before that, we heard Black Dada Nihilismus from the New York Art Quartet. That's a self-titled release. This is a 2008 ESP disc release. The recording was originally released in 1964. Roswell Rudd on trombone, John Chikai on alto saxophone, Louis Worrell on bass, Milford Graves on drums and percussion, and the great Amiri Baraka. And before that, we heard Chorchuva from Makeba Sings, Marian Makeba's RCA Victor 1965 release. Hugh Masekela is the conductor. William Salter, as mentioned by Milford Graves, is the leader. And percussionists are Daniel Big Black Ray, James Chief Bay, Ibaye, and Milford Graves. Before that, we heard Continuous Conversation. That's a Milford Graves solo drums and percussion release. Stories is the name of that release. It was released in 2000 on the Zedek label. And we opened the program with our theme, Nina Simone, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl, from the very best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972. That's an RCA BMG release, originally recorded in 1967. This is a 1998 compilation. Stay tuned for our associate producer, Hank Williams, who has joined us for the exchange with Milford Graves this evening and provided our On the Bandstand segment. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar My Bowl continues.
What was the vibe like at Spirit House in Newark after that?
Oh, they had a different kind of thing going on over there. I was over there a few times, and I did some performance over there a few times. One of the great ones I think I did was with Farrell and Sonny Siroc. We did that trio over there, and then I did a few other things. But they had a little bit more, I think, community participation. At least I was there. You had a nice amount of people that would come out.
Well, it seemed like Baraka took a lot of the lessons that he learned in Harlem implemented them in Newark.
Yeah, well, he didn't have that takeover there. I mean, people here was just trying to take over.
Got you.
Yeah, you had some people up there. Everybody was, you know, it was too much poverty money coming in through there, you know, and they had a hard UAC. And it was always just too much infighting. But people just coming from the outside.
So can we talk a little bit about Albert Eiler and your work with him? And I guess, specifically, the one thing I have to ask you is your performance at John Coltrane's funeral. Can you describe what the scene was like there?
Oh, that scene there. I just remembered that there's a lot of people there. Number one, a lot of people. When I say a lot of people, I'm just not talking about the quantitative thing. I'm talking about the quality of people that were in there, you know? That was John Coltrane. So I said, I got to play because that was part of what John wanted. He wanted Arnett and he wanted Albert to play at his funeral. So we went up, and I just knew that Albert played very soft that day, and I just tried to play full force with aggression. I think I said, that's what John wanted. He didn't want no ballad feeling in here, but I think Albert was taken by the whole nature of the thing.
I heard in another interview that his first response was something to the effect of, how can you play the saxophone when you're crying?
Yeah, I don't know what he said like that, but I know one thing, you know, I was going to let the band drop. You know, I just felt as though that wasn't Albert Eiler we usually play with, you know. And I felt as though he was kind of quiet and easy, you know. So I don't know, what can I say, you know. I think that was just a powerful event. I was just thinking today about that. I was saying, wow. I was thinking about the whole situation with John. Mm-hmm. I said, now, I played at his funeral but never played in his band. I said, wow. So I'm playing with John, but John is not there as a physical body, you know what I mean?
Right.
So we respond to each other. So I got to only deal with a spirit. I think I had a positive relationship with John, which I was talking with someone today because they always ask me about any kind of association I have with Coltrane. And I said, sometimes, you know, when you want to be a part of a John Coltrane Foundation or you want to do a whole historical thing on John, I said, everybody talks about, you know, his music and they just throw Love Supreme out there.
Right.
But there was another side of John Coltrane that could be very inspirational to people that they don't know about. And that was my relationship with Coltrane. And eventually, I think that would have happened if I was more aggressive with John while playing with him. But the last recording he did, and that was the one that he did at Old Otunji's Cultural Center.
Yes.
It was a live recording. Well, I don't know how that's being produced today. I don't know if the liner notes are the way they were a few years back. But in those original liner notes, the person who recorded that, and I guess was part of helped put that together, had to fight for them to put my name in the liner notes. They didn't want to put my name in the liner notes because I was the one that helped John set that up. Don Pullen and myself had put out a duo record together, and we called the label SRP, called Self-Reliance Program, and that was another thing I did. I said, why is everybody waiting for some recording company to record them? I said, we can do this ourselves. We can put out our own LPs. I tried to talk to Sun Ra, but we never got too far on that about organizing because Sun Ra had his Saturn Records. I said, why don't we just put everything together, man, and we can make a strong statement about musicians being self-reliant and not depending on people. Well, I was at the Village Vanguard. I think it was a Sunday afternoon. I don't remember who was playing, but John was there in attendance. And I was there, and I had, you know, one of my recordings, one of the LPs, and I used to walk around with him to advertise it. So John was in the bathroom. We was in the bathroom at the same time. So John said, young man, what do you have there? And I know he knew my face because he seen me playing around because John would be on the scene at times. I said, this is a recording of Don Pullen and myself. We put this out. He said, you guys put that out? I said, yeah, we put it out. He said, are you selling it? I said, yes, man, we're selling it. He said, well, how much does it cost? I said, $5. And he said, I want to buy it right now. I said, John, I can't sell this because this is what I walk around with. So John gave me the $5. And, you know, he took my number, I got his number, and he was out in Huntington. So then I sent him the recording, and he called me up, and he says, you know, I'd like to do something like that. And I was telling John, I said, you John Coltrane. I said, it'd be great in Midtown Manhattan, man, if you got the John Coltrane Cultural Center. And you could start doing this all on your own. So we was really talking. And then I called up this guy, his name was Bernard Drayton, who recorded me and Don at Yale University. And I told Bernard, I said, look, man, he's going to be at the Old Otunji's place. We can set this up. So they was talking and blah, 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 blah. And that's how that materialized. Well, when it was in Milford Graves was involved in this here, man, they said, no, man, don't put him in the liner notes. Because I was instigating at that time about musicians being self-reliant. And so this was another step in Coltrane's life that he was really thinking about that. Of course, his death came, you know, about being a self-reliant person, man, and not just being dictated to all the time.
How many recordings was SRP able to put out?
We put out 2.
Well, thank you for your time. I'm going to hand you back to Joyce.
All right, fine.
All right.
Hi there.
Hi there, okay.
One of the questions that Hank had also wanted to ask about Eiler was a famous session that you did at Slug Saloon.
Right.
And you described it in another interview as being a physically challenging experience. What does that mean?
Oh, because 2 people said it was going to be a physical thing. Albert was one and Don Pullen was the other.
Oh.
Don Pullen came there. And Don Pullen, he's told me personally, he says, no way you're going to play 5 nights, 3 sets to playing the way you play. I said, you wait and see, Don. I said, you wait and see. But Don didn't come to all the sets.
Oh.
Albert Isla, it could have been the first night after the second set. Albert said, I think we're going to have to play some more ballads. I said, ballads? What about all this 1 hour, 45 minute, we're doing all these lofts, man, you know? I wasn't even thinking about, you know, we're doing 3 sets of Slugs for 5 nights. So a friend of mine, he was there every night, and he lived right around the corner from Slugs. So on the breaks, because Slugs didn't have no place to stay in the club itself, and you had to compete if you just wanted to go in there and change your clothes in the bathroom. So during the breaks, I would leave out of there and go and lay on this guy's couch.
Nice.
And when the second set came and the third set come, I'm back around into Slugs. But I was laid up for 2 weeks, about 2 weeks after that. I just blew out.
Thank you.
Every time I thought I was going to cool out, somebody was in the club. So, all right, man, I can't slouch, you know, because, you know, I was a musician spot, too. That was 1967. And I started to become more conscious of the fact that I was like kind of an odd character the way I was playing at the time. And I had a lot of people come out. You know, people would come over, and musicians would, you know, you see them there, they smile and shaking your hand before I even played because my name was being thrown around. And then, you know, I just didn't want to disappoint nobody, you know.
Wow.
You know, everybody's saying, this guy, man, you got to check him out. And I said, wow. To this day, I tell everybody, I said, never let nobody push you beyond what you want to be pushed. You know what I mean? Because I said, it can wipe you out. Wipe you out. I tried it. And Albert tells a story, but he gets it messed up. He said that I passed out. I never passed out, Albert. Yeah, Albert had this messed up, you know what I mean? But Albert knew, boy, at that last set. And you know who's in the room sometimes, you know? And So I said, never again. I don't want to do club gigs where I got to do no 2 and 3 shots. I like concert. You start to resort to things maybe you don't want to, you know what
right.
I mean? And I said, I'd rather just spread it out.
Well, could you tell me about the Institute of Percussive Studies?
Oh, that's Andrew Cyril and myself.
Exactly. Yeah, we've had Andrew Cyril on, and he had mentioned that. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little more about that.
I'm going to tell you this here. I talked to Andrew last week. I can't say too much now other than that may join forces with another institution.
Okay.
We maintained it, but it was something we did in the beginning. And then I guess we both got occupied in a whole bunch of different things, you know? And so that's being, I think, done over, but it's going to be a kind of collaboration more with the thing I'm doing now, you know, with the science and art kind of collaboration. I think that's it.
But it was also a record label.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. IPS Records.
Right. Is there a decision to reissue any of their recordings?
I think that's going to be in the talk.
Okay.
Because we do have some stuff. I think, yeah, we do have some stuff. I got all the masters that hasn't been released or anything. So we got stuff, you know, we just got to regroup again, you know?
Oh, okay. There were a couple of collaborations that I was curious about. And you're going to be at the Village Vanguard on the
right.
10th with John Zorn.
The 9th.
Okay. October 9th.
Right.
John Zorn. How did that come about? You're working with him?
Very simple. John called me to do a solo recording. That's the first one I did with John. Grand Unification. So John recorded me, and John was saying that he realized no one's ever recorded me solo, and he thought my work should be recorded as a soloist. And I said, that's pretty kind of you, John. I didn't know John. Mm-hmm. You know his name, but I really didn't know anything about John. And so I said, that's very kind. And then he talked to other things. I said, you know what, John? I said, you know, so far, you know, this has just been like a business, man. You call me a business. You're a musician. I said, let's play together. And he said, really? I said, yeah. I said, I'm for real. Let's play. And we did the first gig. I didn't know too much about it. I'll tell you one thing. And I always tell people, I say, you know, before you talk negative about someone, you should try to find out more about a person.
Sure.
Before you start following what, listening to whatever other people say, I say, have a one-on-one with a person and then make your own judgment. Or I said, or either check out the person who's telling you all this negativity and see what they're about. And they'll tell you about themselves.
Right.
So I remember when we did the first gig, people were amazed. Not at me. They were amazed at John.
Oh.
They said, wow. I didn't know John can play like that.
Interesting.
I mean, people was telling me some out there stuff. Oh, man, why are you endorsing this guy, man? He can't really play.
Oh, my goodness, no.
Oh, people was telling me. I mean, there was racist stuff involved. Forget about it.
Oh, goodness.
I said, I'm not detecting any of that from John. That's not my relationship with him. You know, we have open, frank talks, you know, about human beings, you know what I mean? Which is great. And I've heard this and heard that. I said, well, you know what? I said, why don't you get to talk to someone sometimes, you know? And talk in a very honest, open way, you know? And I said, maybe you'll learn about people. And my thing is this here, is that I hope you come in with the same intention when we play together that I have. And my intention is to come to say, I'm going to try everything in my spirit, my soul, and everything I have to make you go deep inside yourself and really be a better person than you think you are. And I said, I hope you're thinking that about me. Because if you can do that to me and I can do that to you, I said, we're going to click. I just say to myself, and without sounding egotistical or, you know, all this, I said, if not, Joyce, why are you on the stage, right?
Right.
You got to inspire people. I said, that's what I was always taught. You must come up here with an inspiration. I said, that was my intention. So I've heard that a lot, what they say about John. They say, wow, I didn't know he had it in him to do this and do that, and so on, so on, so on. I said, well, you don't know him. You don't know the person. I always tell people, I'm not saying nothing about no one unless I have a one-on-one with you. And that's how it started. And I think John liked it, and that was it.
Thank you.
and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar and My Bowl's name of this program of which you've been listening. Our guest for this evening is Milford Graves. What you're listening to is Smooth Interaction from Milford Graves' John Zorn Duo. John Zorn's 50th Birthday Celebration Volume 2 on ZEDIC 2004 release. That's Milford Graves on percussion, John Zorn on alto saxophone. Before that, we heard Call and Response, Andrew Cyril, Milford Graves, from Dialogue of the Drums. That's their 1974 IPS Records release. Milford Graves' drum solo, Antiphonal Caller with Audience, and Andrew Cyril is Drum Responses with Audience. And before that, we heard Albert Eiler. That's another subject we didn't get to spend too much time discussing. We got to discuss a little bit. What we heard from Albert Eiler was Love Cry Part 2. That's the 1968 Love Cry release on Impulse Records. Albert Eiler on tenor saxophone, voice, Donald Eiler on trumpet, Alan Silva on bass, and Milford Graves on drums. Before that, we heard Ogunde, and that's from John Coltrane, the Olotunji concert, the last recording we used it while Hank was discussing the events surrounding the funeral of John Coltrane. That was a 1967 Impulse Records release, John Coltrane on tenor and soprano saxophones, Farrell Sanders on tenor saxophone, Alice Coltrane on piano, Jimmy Garrison on bass, Rashid Ali on drums, Algie DeWitt on bata drums, and possibly Juma Santos on percussion. And Juma Santos is, oh, my first percussion instructor. And before that, we had our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer, Hank Williams. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar My Bowl continues.
So I have that you're doing the Village Vanguard at 3 p.m., a matinee on October 9th.
Right.
And you're going to come back in November. November 13th and do another matinee.
But, another matinee.
Christian McBride's going to join you.
Christian McBride.
Wow.
Yeah, that should be interesting.
That should be. Have you played with Christian before?
Never. I know when they had a benefit at the Vision Festival a few years ago downtown.
Yes. Uh-huh.
That's when I did the thing with Joe Lovano. And I didn't know Christian McBride. I know the name, you know. But I really didn't know the face too much. I'd never seen him play anything. But I know he was on the stage. I said, who's that bass player? I said, he sounds pretty good. You know, I said, who's this guy? You know what I mean? But you see somebody, you don't know people around, and I'm saying, see, there's people around, you know, that can play, but they don't get a chance to get exposed. Well, Christian McBride's getting exposed. I said, I don't be in the scene all the time. And he came over, and he introduced himself, and he was very polite and very respectful the way he came over. And so I said, well, maybe one day it'll happen. I told John, and John said, maybe I should count me in. I said, fine, that'd be great.
Oh, it's wonderful. Well, you'll be surprised of how he'll be able to play with you all.
I think so, you know.
He actually did Vision Festival with his father, his uncle, and Marshall Allen.
Oh, okay.
Three basses and Marshall Allen.
Okay. So, yeah, that should be very interesting.
Are you doing the Stone as well?
I'm doing the Stone in December.
Oh, in December. Okay.
With Mark Rebo and Shahzad Ismaili.
All right. Well, that's going to be great, too.
I think so.
Well, definitely looking forward to that.
Right.
You recorded with David Murray.
Yes.
It was just the two of you. Real deal.
Real deal, right.
How did that come about?
That came about because the record company, I think, told him to contact me.
Oh!
So David called me. I said, David, you remembered me, huh? I didn't see you ever call me, man. So they made that a DIW.
Right.
They wanted to record me.
I see.
And so they asked, and they pretty well knew what I was about because, you know, most of the people who was recording with them, they told you to play some standards.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Maybe I was talking about they wanted you to do a few standards or whatever. We didn't do no standards.
No.
No, we do. We had to do it. I said, no,
that's
no.
Right.
You know, but they knew me from Japan, you know, okay. Back in 77. That's how they came about, you know. That was at their suggestion.
Now, there's one thing we haven't discussed, and that's you recording as a leader. Percussion Ensemble, that was your first release as a leader.
Yeah, it was Sonny Morgan.
Yeah. How did it come about that you just, okay, I'm going to record as a leader?
Oh, Bernard Stoneman wanted me to do that. Actually, the recordings with Giuseppe, Bernard Stoneman asked me, after New York Hard Quartet, Bernard said, I want you to do something, you know, as a band leader. And then I told Bernard, well, is this guy Giuseppe Logan? I said, he's older than me, man. And I said, I'm still a young guy. I said, no, put everything in his name. I'll just play with Giuseppe. And then the second time, I think he asked me maybe to do a percussion thing or something. And I said, okay, I'll do a percussion thing. Actually, that was supposed to be more than two people. Sonny Morgan was the person that I thought that had the ability to do it with me and to allow people to rest in peace. Some of them not on planet, but I did ask other drummers, but they didn't have the concept. So actually, what I did was I just didn't tell nobody too much what to do, but I gave them directions. At that time, I was more conscious and intellectual of playing in those meters, you know. And so I wanted the people to play in different kind of meters. So I would lay out these things, but most of the guys who was just playing regular stuff, they didn't know nothing about no hard time signatures. And so they couldn't cut it. So I wound up being Sonny and myself.
Got it. Now, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly. Bobby?
Bobby, right.
How did that come about?
Bobby was with Arthur Doyle and Hugh Glover.
That's right.
That was a trio I was working with for a little bit there.
Okay.
Yeah, that was an SRP. I thought I only had two. No, that was an SRP thing, you know. And
what is SRP? Because I heard you and Hank talking about that. And
Self-Reliance Program.
Okay, and the label was IPS.
Well, IPS, that was the Institute of Percussive Studies with Andrew.
But the label that...
Two separate ones, yeah. But I don't remember, to tell you the truth.
Okay.
Those things there, well, I never put those things out to make no money. We never made no money or nothing like that. At that time, I was telling Hank, I just wanted to be an example and a model for musicians that we don't have to keep waiting for some record company to record us. And we should be able to record ourselves.
Right.
You know, that was money I put together and just put that stuff out. I mean, I couldn't do no more with it than that because I wasn't going to go around and be a record company per se. But, you know, you make it look official. But I just had to do something because I just couldn't be around musicians. Everybody's complaining and we're not doing nothing about it.
Right.
You know, dependency things.
Space-Time Redemption that you did with Bill Laswell, basically.
Oh, yes.
How did that come into being? You even have a recording on here called Sonny Chirac.
Oh, that must, yeah, that was, that Bill had to say that. But
see.
You know.
Okay.
You know, I'm at a thing right now. As a younger guy, I was doing a whole lot of running around trying to organize and all of that. Right now, I said, look, put some names to it.
Oh.
And then I'll see if I disagree. And
okay.
They say it's fine. I said, fine, it's cool, man.
Okay.
You know, Joyce, I want to cool out as much as I can now to reserve my energy.
Got it.
So I trust Bill. I said, Bill, that's cool. Let it go, man. Let it go, you know. So I just let Bill do all that stuff, you know, and go to the studio, record, and, you know, we do what we got to do. But that was the recording company who wanted us.
Okay.
Bill calls me up, and, you know, and he says that people want to, either they hear us together, because, you know, even when we play with either a trio, quartet, or whatever, with John involved, anything, you know, there's always a particular moment in there where it's just Laswell and myself. And so different people have mentioned that they like the way Bill and I play together. So I think there's probably some people out there, producers or whatever else, like that too. And that's why they asked us just to do it as a duo.
Okay. So I take it primarily, since you're sort of taking a backseat to recording right now, I guess, are you focused more on your science and herbalism and martial arts and everything else?
Well, that's all included.
Right.
But basically what I'm focusing on is basically the straight out science art collaboration now. For me personally, that's the way to go, you know.
Yeah.
I think that's going to open up some new doors, I think. A new community. And actually, let me see now. I'll have a day's rest before I go into the Vanguard in November because I'm going to be in Italy for 5 days.
Wow.
And I'm going to be over there as part of the science art collaboration. And this is the people I'm collaborating with in Italy of the University of Bologna's Medical School. they're putting on a very interesting program. I'm going to be doing a duo, and I'm going to be doing a duo with, I don't know what kind of set I'm going to have, but I'll have a different kind of maybe drums I want to set up. But the main thing is I got to get these drum skins vibrating. And the partner I'm going to have, check this out, Joyce, is going to be stem cells on stage.
What?
Yeah, they're going to have a whole science thing hooked up there on the stage.
Stem cells.
Yeah, and when I'm playing, all the vibrations what I'm doing is going to be stimulating and vibrating these stem cells that's going to be in some kind of medium they're going to have.
Oh, my.
And they're going to have this stuff projected, all in motion, on a very micro level, projecting on a big screen, man.
Wow.
And then what they're going to be doing, they're going to take this right back to the lab and see if there was any effect on this.
Interesting. Okay.
And this is being done by be scientists there, doctors, some of the conservatory people. So it's another major thing. But I'm one of the headlines with this guy who I've collaborated with. So I'm very happy about this.
Now, you've done something similar, but not with stem cells.
Oh, no. Not like, yeah. But indirectly. But these guys these are the guys. These are, you know, microbiologists, cardiologists. You
right.
know. And they contacted me 3 years ago. I've been talking with these people for 3 years.
Okay.
Sending them different kind of frequencies to be testing. And the stuff I've been sending them has been a major breakthrough.
Wow.
They realize nothing like this has ever been shown. You know, I write these computer programs, so I take the heart sounds and convert them into, like, melodies. And so what they do is they stimulate these stem cells and these incubators with vibration. So they've been showing these things has been changing into different kind of stem cells. And so this is going to break out big soon.
Will people be able to follow the progress of this somewhere?
Oh,
is
yeah.
A website
I think so.
Or something?
Yeah, they're putting all this up now. They're getting everything in order, you know. I'll send you that link.
And we'll put it up on our website. So
yeah, they can read all about this here. And I can also send just a link to the patent that three of us took out.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I know it's been approved in Europe as a part of this whole thing. It's kind of technical, but, you know, it's information.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I'm happy about this because just the whole science that I use and the mathematics that I use and the way I build these algorithms is something that I've been thinking all the time. There's something into which I hope that the whole drum community will appreciate the work that I've been doing to show that all the way from the motherland into what we do from the Brazilians, the Haitians, the Cubans, the Trinidadians, Jamaicans, you know, all of this stuff we do, this stuff that we're playing, it came from somewhere. And so showing scientifically that the drum came from the heart is more than a metaphor. Trying to change the whole scope on this here that when people hear us playing, I'm trying to get people more conscious that when you're playing something, you know, there's a deeper scientific understanding of this as well as other than the spiritual thing. Let me say this here. I just feel that, and this is when people may look at me and I may upset some people, but I said, it's not about upsetting people. It's about the whole thing of how we play what we do, you know, and that it's this whole concept of the mathematics that we use, and it doesn't fit in to the way the body vibrates, and it's this metronomic thing. And we've been so introduced to it, we've become accustomed to that, to think that's what's happening. Then when you really see how a lot of the stuff is not done in the metric way, even in the tonal way, and an amazing thing I find that when I do all these conversions and really take a hot sound waveform apart and really break it down, first thing people say, that sounds like free jazz. So that's the big thing I'm saying. This is going to, I think I'm working on this whole thing of saying that what we're doing in the so-called way, so-called atonal way, and so much you're playing out of meter, you're playing all this here and all of that there. I said, well, this is how we function on a deep cellular level, which would be more related to, you know, in quantum physics or quantum mechanics.
Got it.
So some deep stuff, you know what I mean?
Right.
And it may not have the greatest kind of commercial appeal because people have been so
a
process in a way. Yeah. You know, we don't really know what this stuff sounds like deeper within. It's all superficial. So that's the great part about this here. I've been able to see that this is more than some avant-garde or way out people playing. This came from something else. So there is something to a person like Frank Wright who said that, well, man, he didn't play no tunes. He couldn't read music. I said, yeah, what's wrong with that? You know, maybe if you're not going to get no gigs, you're not part of that kind of clique. But I said, some of the people that was playing like that, I said, they had some heavy-duty stuff going and they didn't even realize it. They were so deep inside that there's no kind of formula they're going to put for this because the formula keeps changing. There's no stagnant, constant mathematical values that you give to. They're all variable.
Well, blues
you know?
Players didn't read music, so a lot of blues players didn't read music.
Oh, no. Yeah. I know. That's really the stuff, you know?
Now, you had a quote I read somewhere. Is most important thing was what was coming out of your instrument when you were playing and how it affected people. Is that sort of your motto that you live by?
Oh, yes. I was in Kyoto, and I went over there and did a duet with Toshi Tsuchitori. And I was telling Toshi, I said, this was a great experience. because I said, as I'm getting older, you settle down and you really start to realize what's happening sometimes. A lot of things, you just take things for granted. And so we finished the performance, and I'm down in the dressing room, and I'm cooling out, because this is 2 days after I arrived on a long trip from JFK into Kyoto, and that jet lag was still kicking. And I went on that stage, and I said, you know what? I got to play for these people. And so I'm in the dressing room, I'm cooling out, and Toshi opens the door and said, there's a line of people outside who want to see you.
Wow.
And it was all these old and young Japanese people all out in line. I said, well, look at this. And I just had to jump to attention. And when they was coming in there one by one, then they start piling in, taking pictures, gifts, signing recordings.
Wow.
But I told Toshi, I said, you know what? It wasn't about so much the gifts and just signing. I said, the emotional expression of these people was unbelievable. And it cut through all kind of language, culture, religion, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I said to myself, and it was just trying to express themselves. They didn't know how to express themselves. Just big smiles. You can see tears coming out of some people's eyes, you know. And I said, wow. And I said, that meant more to me than having an autograph or somebody giving me some technical thing, what you did with your right hand, your left hand. I said, that had nothing to do with nothing.
Wow.
I said, that's what I'm saying. I said, how do you feel this stuff? And when you go into a place like a culture like Japan, the kind of discipline and stuff they have, when you can go deep down inside and they appreciate you, almost like a liberated person, a person who can improvise, who's saying, that's it. You know, they're showing us what it is to be a human being, not a part of this religion, this culture, this political group, or nothing. And Joyce, I said, I did my job.
Excellent.
This is what I want. How do I reach you? Because I said, what I do, I said, it's bigger than me.
Now, there's one last thing I want to ask you. Sonny Chirac.
Right.
You worked on Black Woman.
Right.
What was that interaction like? How did that feel?
It felt great. I liked Sonny and what we did as a group. And I think it's good when somebody asks me to perform with them, and they don't come over and say, either you're playing too much, man, you got to cool out your energy and all that there. And with Sonny, I was just liberated. I said, you can play your tunes. I said, I have a problem knowing your tunes, you know. I said, however, can I express what your tune is doing to me? If I can express how I interpret that tune without you saying anything, then I have no problem. But I have been in the past with people who would come and then would make comments later, and I said, wow, what was that about? I said, that's not me. So some people, when they write, they're doing that to control you because of their limitation. And when you go beyond that and try to take something, I would never write a piece of music. And if somebody did something that wasn't on the chart, and if I honestly felt it, I would say, that's great. I said, you know, you want to insert that into the chart? If you want to write that down, if you can note that, put it in.
Actually, that's one thing I've noticed. You know how people say with Miles Davis, he was all about the spaces.
Right.
You're not about spaces, are you?
Well, you know what? You know, I turned down a gig twice at Miles.
Really?
I turned down a gig twice at Miles, yeah. I thought it was going to be a problem. I didn't want Miles telling me on the stage to shut up.
So how did this come about?
One of Miles' friends was a friend of mine. So she called me from Miles' house and said that she took my recording over to Miles' house. The LP one I did with Don Pullen. And she was telling Miles that Miles should hire me. And so Miles said, will he play time? He's a revolutionary, huh? And I said, right on the phone, I said, I don't think so. You know? I didn't want to.
Oh, okay.
I think with Dottie and myself, we did a duo record recently in May, you know. We did a duo record. And I listened to that, and I was watching the space, and I said, I said, that's probably how I would have played with Miles, because it sounds pretty good. It sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
And remember what I told you earlier? I said, people say what you can't do.
Right.
I said, but you don't know what people can do. I said, I play according to the set I'm in, you know? And there's a reason why I'll cram stuff in, you know? And I'm going to tell you something. I'd be slow. These days, relative.
Oh,
I said, if I really took that stuff out here, I know it's going to be. People are going to get uptight with me. But those other, in the past, they said, man, you got to slow it up, man. You've been playing too much stuff. And my thing is, I said, well, maybe you're playing too little.
Right.
I don't know if I'm playing too much, you know. You should play more.
Right.
And I'm just seeing, you know, I just think I deal with the physiology and all my research over all the years, seeing how our body can handle signals. as long as they don't come in a disruptive way. And I've been kind of successful, so, you know, all of my journeys throughout. And I get good reception, whereas people normally wouldn't get reception. Going into these areas where they don't know about no jazz, and I could be in the countryside of Japan. I was a big hit in Fest Act when I was over there in Africa, you know, and I was getting across with people, you know what I mean? I said, if this is so harmful and way out, the only problems I'd get is people who have to really train, you know, in the conservatory.
Mm-hmm.
But lay people, I don't have it.
Yeah.
And some people try to write and say, well, he's abstract, he's doing this and doing that. And there's a way of doing it. You know, some people do it, and they try to crowd themselves in, and they just be banging. They ain't playing. They're just banging. I said, no, you don't want to do it like that. And people get just going to get physical, just think they're playing fast and blah, 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 blah. I said, but you got to have some, you got to have a story to it.
Right.
If there's no storyline coming out of there, then it doesn't penetrate. So if you just if you're just doing a bunch of strokes, if you're beating the drum and not playing, that's two different things.
That is true. I think beating is abusive. So
that's right. Yeah, you don't want that. You know what I mean?
Well, is there something you want to tell our WBAI audience before we wrap up?
I don't know, other than I've been talking to BAI for I don't know how long. Not today, time wise, for over the years and over the years and over the years, you know.
Yeah, well, I know you did a recording in the Free Store, the WBAI Free Music Store. So
that was the Bobby record.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, that was right in there. Yeah, so BI has been, you know, pretty cool.
Well, thank you so much for spending this time with us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
Hopefully we'll see you at Village Vanguard or The Stone.
That's right. Either one of those two.
Okay. Thank you much, Mr. Grass.
All right, good talking with y'all.
You too. Peace.
All right, take it easy.
And you're listening to the closing moments of Sugar in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones. I was joined by our associate producer, Hank Williams, for a discussion with our guest for this evening, Milford Graves, percussionist, drummer, acupuncturist, herbalist, gardener, builder, scientist, inventor, martial arts master, and all-around great guy. There was so much that we could not include for this evening's program. As a matter of fact, there will be a web extra where Milford Graves discusses his musical relationship with Jimmy Giuffre. What you're listening to right now is Ba. That's Milford Graves' 1976 IPS release. Bobby, Milford Graves on percussion, Arthur Doyle and Hugh Glover on reeds. Don't forget to check us out at sugarmybowl.org. We'll be back on Sunday, July 22nd. I'd like to thank Jake McGinsky, the director of Milford Graves' Full Mantis, for sharing information about the film. Once again, Milford Graves' Full Mantis begins screening at Metrograph at 7 Ludlow Street on July 13th. And the link for Metrograph is at our Sugar in My Bowl website. Stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa, coming up next, right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.